Padma Viswanathan began as a playwright in Canada, but now with two novels, The Toss of a Lemon and The Ever After of Ashwin Rao, she sees herself as a writer of books. Here's what her husband, poet Jeffrey Brock, has to say about her work.
Some of my favorite things about her writing are the different voices and characters that she speaks from. I love this Ashwin Rao character, and she has a short story called Border Guards that is hilarious. So there's a lot of formal variety. It's like every time she writes a piece, she's trying to write a new kind of story or novel. I love that.
Jeffrey Brock on fiction by his wife, Padma Viswanathan, who was awarded the 2017 Porter Fund Literary Prize at the University of Arkansas, Fayetteville, where the two have been teaching and raising their family since 2006. We'll hear readings from her novels while he shares her favorite poem from his award-winning book, Voices, Bright Flags, today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where I talked with the husband and wife team in 2015. Part one of our conversation focuses on her work, beginning with the book that's loosely based on her great-great-grandmother. I'm Angela Elam, and here's Padma Viswanathan.
The first novel, The Toss of a Lemon, is a historical work. I had to do a lot of research. First, I interviewed my grandma about her childhood, about her grandmother's story in particular. She was raised by her grandmother. And I had about 200 pages of transcripts from those conversations. And I put those aside. I went to India. I stayed for long periods of time in the places where those stories took place. I still wasn't able really to write. And in that time, I read an interview with Anne-Marie MacDonald, who is a Canadian writer I deeply admire, who has a novel called Fall on Your Knees, which also was based in her family's history in Newfoundland and Cape Breton. And I recalled Anne-Marie saying that she wrote her novel out of sequence, and it's a big, thick historical novel. It's riveting. I mean, it has a mystery at its center, and it's a real page-turner, but she wrote it out of sequence. And she was a playwright to start with. I was also a playwright. We both came out of a tradition of collective theater creation where you create scenes and then you sort of have them all on cards and you put them in different order and then start fashioning a play around that. And it remains a common method among sort of social action-based theater, also research-based theater and collective creation. And that was the tradition that I came out of. So Anne-Marie said that she had all this research and she would just start writing on whatever caught her fancy, and that eventually it mounted into a novel. And I thought that was a much less intimidating way to write my first novel, which was going to be, you know, a huge fact-based historical novel, than to try to write it beginning to end. Ultimately, the very beginning of the novel was the first bit that I wrote. It wasn't until I could hear the voice of the person telling the story that I could properly embark on the story. And that was the first thing I heard, really, was what is still the opening of the novel.
Wow, that's neat that that stayed.
Yeah, it happened with my first play also. It hasn't happened with anything since, really. But in those two instances, it worked that way.
I wondered if you can give us a snippet of that.
Yes, sure. I've be happy to. So this is the opening of The Toss of a Lemon. The year of the marriage proposal, Sivakami is 10. She is neither tall nor short for her age, but she will not grow much more. Her shoulders are narrow, but appear solid, as though the blades are fused to protect her heart from the back. She carries herself with an attractive stiffness, her shoulders straight and always aligned. She looks capable of bearing great burdens, not as though born to a yoke, but perhaps as though born with a yoke within her. She and her family live in Samanthibakkam, some hours away by bullock cart from Shorapati, which had been her mother's place before marriage. Every year they return to Shorapati for a pilgrimage. They fill a pot at the Kaveri River and trudge it up to the hilltop temple. These are pleasant, responsible, God-fearing folk who seek the blessings of their gods on any undertaking and any lack thereof. They maintain awe toward those potentially wiser or richer than they, like the young man of Shorapati, who is blessed with the ability to heal. No one in their family is sick, but still they go to the healer. They may be less than totally healthy and simply not know. One can always use a preventative, and it never hurts to receive the blessings of a blessed person. This has always been the stated purpose of the trip, and Sivakami has no reason to think this one is any different. Hanumaratnam, the healer, puts his palms together in a friendly namaskaram, asks how they have been, and whether they need anything specific. They shyly shake their heads, and he queries, with a penetrating squint, "Nothing? Sivakami is embarrassed by her parents, who are acting like impoverished peasants. They owe this man their respect, but they are Brahmins too, and literate like him. They can hold up their heads. She's smiling to herself at his strange name, a hybrid of Hanuman, the monkey god, and Ratnam, which means gem. The suffix, she understands, is attached to the name of every man in the region, but no one is named for the monkey. Her mother and father cast glances at each other, and then her father clears his throat. Our daughter here has just entered Gurubalam. We are about to start searching for a groom. Oh, well, Hanumaratnam responds with a wink. I deal in medicine, not charms. Sivakami's parents giggle immoderately. Their daughter stares at the packed dust of the Brahmin quarter street. Her three older brothers fidget. But you have my blessings, Hanumaratnam continues, making a small package of some powder. And this, dissolved in milk and drunk each day, this will give you strength. Just generally, it will help. Then he looks at Sivakami. She doesn't look up. When he asks her parents, have you done the star chart yet? His voice sounds different. They haven't. Come at dusk. I'll do it for you. What could be better? The humble folk trip back to their relatives four doors down the street for snacks and happy anticipation of their consultation with the auspicious young man who also has some fame as an astrologer. At that strange hour that gives the impression of light, even though each figure is masked by darkness, Sivakami's father, with two of the male relatives, finds Hanumaratnam on his veranda. He cannot make out the young man's features, but the slant of his chest and head suggest wisdom and peace. So young and a widower, by a freak accident, his wife drowned in the Kaveri River before she ever came to live with him. His parents were already dead. He lives with relatives while his own house, his parents' home, on the Brahmin quarter, stays locked, dark, and still. Hanumaratnam stands to greet them. They take their seats. They make brief small talk as his aunt brings tumblers of yogurt churned with lemon water and salt. He examines the chart by the kerosene lamp while the men finger their shoulder towels. He makes some calculations. He purses his lips and takes in a sharp breath before speaking. I must say it. I have just entered Gurubalam myself. Sivakami's father hesitates. Oh? I will make more detailed calculations, but this is my reasoned guess. Your daughter's horoscope is compatible with mine.
That's the opening of the novel, The Toss of a Lemon, by Padma Viswanathan, and this is New Letters on the Air. The story that appeared in New Letters magazine all those years ago was part of the seed for this novel, in that you had published just a few pieces of what would ultimately end up in the novel, and yet by the time it did show up in the novel, it's very different. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Yeah, at a certain point, I was encouraged to try to publish some pieces from it. I only published three pieces, and one of them was in New Letters, and it's the longish short story about the witch that lives next door to my main character. The witch is taken directly from my family history. There really was a witch who lived next door to my great-great-grandmother, and she really did become a witch because she accepted a bribe from her mother-in-law, a necklace of gold coins, to accept the curse that her mother-in-law was afflicted with, that she had to cast these nasty spells on people. So I like to say that on every page of the novel, you'll see something from my family history, something from my research, and something that I just made up, but it's really hard to tell what I just made up and what, quote-unquote, really happened. So New Letters published that story. It was tremendous for me. It's wonderful, you know, affirmation that I really could write or that my writing existed or something. But the form of it, it was a full short story for that witch. Her story is in the novel, but really what in New Letters took up about 20, 25 pages takes up no more than a couple pages in the book.
Yeah, so it got transformed in the process of
making the novel. The book had to digest it, really.
Yeah. I'm also here with Padma's husband, Jeffrey Brock, who is a poet. And it's interesting you both have ties to New Letters magazine because, Jeff, you had a couple of poems published in there, and then you also had a translation of Pavese in one of the...
Yes.
2000 issue before your book came out.
Right. That's... Yeah, I think all the things I published in New Letters were before I had any book published. So.
You're readers for each other. Padma, what's your favorite type of poem that Jeffrey
Wow. I've never been asked that question before, and I don't think I ever really thought of it that way. I have to say that John Brown poem has long been one of my absolute favorites of Jeff's. I've recently been able to not cry at the end of it. Probably I admire most the many things he does that I can't imagine doing myself, right? I mean, this is the great attraction of, I suppose, any writer that you admire. In this case, it's my partner also, is, you know, my desire to know his mind. And then these surprising things come out of it. And the way he told the story of John Brown, the penetration of the essential emotion there, it's so unexpected. I mean, that's why for years and years I would hear him read that poem and I would always cry.
Wow.
At the end of it, at the nexus of the sun recognizing, but see, now I'm misting up again, the nexus of the sun recognizing the greatness of his dad and the way that he experienced it. That is where that poem takes you in so little time. I mean, this is the other wonder of poetry to me, and of living with a poet, is how does he do that in fewer than 30 lines? It takes me 400 pages to get there, you know, so it's quite wondrous.
Jeffrey, I know that you've dealt with so many different characters, but you wanted to write about John Brown, but you couldn't find a way to enter into it. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. An idea for a poem is not enough. You have to find some other way in, some way through language or through voice or through character. And so, you know, I had wanted to write about John Brown for a long time just because he's a figure who is, you know, one of the most fascinating figures in our history. And it took me a long time before I found a way into his character. I had read about him and I had gone to Harper's Ferry, but I hadn't encountered anything that brought him to life to me in any kind of new way until a friend recommended that I read a letter written by his eldest son some 20 or 30 years after John Brown's death about how John Brown disciplined his children. And that was the sort of way into this poem.
Why don't I have you read that?
It's called Day of Settlement, December 2nd, 1859, and that's the date that John Brown was hung after being captured at Harper's Ferry by Colonel Robert E. Lee. And it's got an epigraph from his son, John Brown Jr., and the epigraph is, "I dared not refuse to obey, but at first I did not strike hard. Harder, he said. Harder, harder." Day of Settlement, December 2nd, 1859. We knew the rules and punishments. 3 lashes for lack of diligence, 8 for disobeying mother or telling lies. No blood, he'd say, and no remission. Came a day he started keeping my account as at a store. And came another, he called me to the tannery, a Sunday, day of settlement. I'd paid 1/3 the owed amount, when he, to my astonishment, handed the Blue Beach switch to me, tearful. The greatest of my fears, never his whippings, but those tears. And so it was my father paid himself the balance I had owed, our mingled blood a token of a thing that went unnamed, his love. This nation, too, is his bad child, and she has failed him, made him wild with rage and grief, and will be scourged nearly to death before she, purged, may rise and stand. No blood, I hear him saying still, and no remission. So hang him today, Virginia. Cheer his body swaying in the air. Tomorrow you will learn what's true. Hanging's a thing he's done for you.
Day of Settlement, December 2nd, 1859. From the section called Staring Back at Us, a gallery of the book Voices, Bright Flags by Jeffrey Brock, the winner of the 9th Anthony Hecht Poetry Prize, and this is New Letters on the Air. And Jeffrey is here with his wife, Padma. And Padma, The Toss of a Lemon, too, I think it was shortlisted for several prizes as well, right?
It was, yes.
And now your second novel, The Ever After of Ashwin Rao. Both these novels were first published in Canada, is
correct,
that right?
Correct, yes.
And this is a very different novel than your first one.
I'm glad you think so.
and the interesting thing, too, is I read that your undergraduate degree was in sociology.
Correct.
And I feel like with this character, you're kind of going back to those roots. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about The Ever After of Ashwin Rao.
Yeah, so Ashwin Rao is a psychologist. He was trained in Canada, born and grew up in India, came to Canada to train at McGill, and eventually, through various circumstances, ends up back in India. Ashwin is my invention, but the novel does explore the consequences of some real-world events. The main one is the bombing of an Air India jet in 1985, which left from Canada. It had passengers that it picked up in Vancouver, Toronto, and Montreal. It was on its way to Heathrow when it blew apart, about an hour outside of Heathrow, closest to County Cork, Ireland, actually. All 329 people aboard were killed. In the world of my novel, Ashwin's sister and his sister's children were aboard that plane. The Canadian government really had primary responsibility. First of all, they should have heeded warnings before the bombing. They should have more quickly investigated what happened after. Ultimately, it took them 18 years to bring anybody to trial for this. So in 2003, Ashwin hears that the trial is about to commence in Vancouver. He goes there, sits in the courtroom, realizes he has no interest in the trial's outcome, that it really will change nothing about his life and the things that he has suffered as a result of the bombing. He looks around the room and wonders, what about these people like me, people who lost, people who've been waiting for so long to have any sort of sense clearly of what people believe happened then? And he retreats to the library. He's not only a psychologist who practices as a therapist, but also a writer. He specializes in narrative therapy, which I didn't make up. People think that I invented this branch of therapy for my own purposes, but narrative therapy has existed. In a weird way, Ashwin is an Indian man a generation older than me. Nobody would think that I'm like him, but he really is an alter ego for me in various ways. And I think that if I hadn't become a novelist, it's likely I would have become a therapist. So he does some research.
Well, when you think about it, they're both character studies.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I think they're driven by the same sorts of curiosities, really. So Ashwin finds out, as I did in the course of doing research for his project, that no in-depth study has been done of these families, that they surface in the news, people want to talk to them when the bombing comes back in the news for whatever reason, and then they fall back out of the public consciousness. So he decides to undertake a study in which he's going to interview 12 families across Canada who lost loved ones in the bombing. What really happens is he ends up getting embroiled with one family in a town I call Lohikarma. It's a fictional version of the town in BC, Nelson, British Columbia, where I was born, this kind of slightly isolated hippie college town. And in uncovering their secrets and becoming entangled with their family, his own demons are sort of drawn out and to some extent put to rest. But he's a cranky, irascible figure, very different vibe from the sort of more inviting narrative voice of my first book. But I really felt like he was, again, the person who permitted me to tell this story the way I wanted it told. I did do a lot of research in sociology, and I have done a lot of that kind of interviewing. But, you know, I wrote the novel and he writes the study in this case.
Right. And we have to say that the interviews that he did are your fabrications. They're not based on actual interviews that were done of any of the families. And that's where you as a novelist stepped in. But the event itself was real.
The event was real. Yeah, I didn't interview any families in the course of researching for the novel. I did a lot of reading about the political antecedents to the bombing, which I felt were very important, make some speculations about possible results from it. But at its core, I made up a family and I put them through this trauma. I wasn't going to, first of all, intrude on the grief of families who lost, especially because I was interested in the unexpected consequences of grief, the things that are intimate and embarrassing, unexpected to ourselves, things that nobody should be, you know, expected to tell another person. That's the territory of the novelist. Also because I wasn't going to generalize across anybody's experiences. That, again, I think that's the province of psychology and I think it's useful, but that was Ashwin's task. That wasn't mine.
Right. Well, you're going to think I just want you to read the beginnings of all your books, but can we have you read the beginning of this one?
Absolutely. The Ever After of Ashwin Rao, 9th of June, 2004. At 3 in the morning, New Delhi's air is mostly remnants. This is its quietest hour, though the city is not still. The sounds of night business concluding, morning business being prepared, all sorts of shrouded transactions these carry. but the air itself is nostalgic, with acrid exhaust, cookstove smoke, the dying breaths of jasmine and bougainvillea breaking down into each other, night exhaling the prior day. Please excuse poetic lapse. I orient by smell. The night scent excited me as I locked my door and ascended, then stopped, descended, and re-entered the flat to check again. Taps off, windows locked, no food anywhere. I don't normally second-guess this way. I have many neuroses, just not this one. But I would be away in Canada for a year. I would leave my key with a fellow resident, but didn't want to leave her a reason to use it. I locked the door again and went upstairs to lay the key in its envelope on Vigia's threshold. She was a widow I barely considered a friend, particularly because she wanted to be more than that. Fetching my bag from the landing, I trotted briskly down the stairs, across the courtyard, and into the carport, clicking my tongue for the cat. Dirty orange fur, three rickety legs, strangely swollen jowls, it slunk around as though hoping to be hit. I put out last night's takeaway, lamb biryani, at the usual spot. I had never wanted to keep a pet, but was overcome by the urge to feed the patchy creature. A memory knocked. My nephew, Anand, at 6 months maybe. When did they start with the pablum? My sister, Kritika, was feeding him. She called me over. Watch, Ashwin! As she lifted the little spoon toward his face and he opened his mouth so wide, his head bobbing a little, the eyes so serious, as though this were a contract he had agreed to fulfill. Survival. My sister and I laughed until our sides hurt. And 2 years after Anand came my niece, Asha. Asha, my Asha, the child of my life. Sometimes I thought I recalled a whisper of her smell, green grapes and the pages of books, perhaps a hint of nutmeg. But even the motion of my mind turning toward it fanned it away. The cat still hadn't appeared, and my auto rickshaw was waiting. Airport, I told the driver, no good morning necessary. He had been, for 15 years, my favorite among those at the corner rank, almost surly, always prompt. He tossed his beady and unthrottled his engine. 2 weeks from today, June 23rd, would be the 19th anniversary of a jet bombing that killed 326 people I didn't know and three I did. Kritika, Anand, Asha. It had taken nearly 18 years to drag two perpetrators into court. Last spring, April 2003, I had gone to Vancouver to witness the trial's start. My first time back in Canada since 1985, a screaming reluctance to see it had battled in me with a driving compulsion to see it. Guess which one? Victims' families, along with various other concerned parties and or gawkers, came from all over. They milled in the grand atrium at the provincial courthouse in Vancouver, their hot, thick optimism mingling with a slight steam from the bloodthirsty and giving me, what is it, when one's skin crawls, the heebie-jeebies. The atrium's high glass walls gave the all-too-obvious image of transparency. Kafka's trial could never happen here. Glass houses, Canadians don't throw stones. On the government side, the excitement was both more stately and more tawdry. Press releases, security expenditures, and a bullet and bomb-proof courtroom custom-built several circles of hell underground, down where the sun don't shine. Only two of the many hot-air buffoons allegedly involved in the bombing were standing trial. I would name them, but what's in a name? I try to block their faces, but they rise in my mind's eye. Specimens, bad examples of their community, their race, their species, bad men. I felt the trial to be a sham, and yet I had gone to see it. Why? And furthermore, why? Why a sham? Because it came so very late, and after so much had changed, from the political situations that fed the bomb plot to the security situations that permitted it, that it would do nothing to prevent future terrorist acts. The accused did not regret what they had done, but neither would they plant any more bombs. But what of punishment, you might ask? I hated those men. I might gladly have punished them with my own hands, not that I ever have done such a thing. But for the government to mete out what? Justice? Hardly. No government in the world possessed a moral scepter weighty enough to flog these puny fellows.
That's the opening of the novel The Ever After of Ashwin Rao. And you're listening to Padma Viswanathan. You guys cover the gamut between the two of you. And I'm just curious about your working relationship, because you also have two children. You also both teach at the University of Arkansas. How do you balance things?
Balance is a tricky word, because a lot of the time we do feel out of balance with all those things that you mentioned going on, teaching and kids and writing.
I like to say that our main superpower may be my parents who live with
us.
That is a superpower.
It really is. It's something I always wanted. I grew up with my grandmother. And yeah, my parents retired when our first child was born. And my mother came to just help with the baby and cooked amazing food every night and helped us out in so many ways. And at the end of that semester, she said, "Do you want me to convince your dad to retire and we will move to Tucson?" And we rented them a little house between us and the university. And so then at the end of that year, when we moved to Fayetteville, we bought a house big enough that they could have the top floor, and within a few years managed to build them an apartment. We needed a garage. And so we had an apartment built to my mother's tastes, especially. My daughter calls it all the family that lives on our driveway because we're right across the driveway from each other. And so we have supper together every night. And so that has provided us more than anything that space and time to write. We've been able to hand off our children to people who love them as much as we do. And so if we ever get this sort of space and solitude, it generally comes from having that community of support.
Yeah, whatever balance we have, we owe to them in large part.
That is a superpower. I mean, you're joking about it, but an extended family like that to help out in this sort of situation is amazing. Well, I know, Jeffrey, that your father, Van Brock, is also a poet.
Yes.
And I read somewhere that your mother...
Yes, she was also a poet. She never published a book of poems, but she published in journals, and my father published several books.
Van lives in Fayetteville also, actually. He lives just down the...
He moved
a few
there.
Blocks away from us, and each of our children also goes to his place after school one day a week, and one night we have supper at his place, so we have both his grandparental and poetic influences.
Wow, that's great, yeah. Too. I guess if you had two driveways.
Yeah, exactly. He would be on the other driveway. It's really very close, though. He's just a few blocks away.
Yeah. Well, we actually have a new Letters on the Air program with him.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
When is that from?
2005, but it's not an interview. It's a show that we made out of his reading at the writer's place.
How
we had
wonderful.
Recorded it. We'll end part one of this 2015 interview with Padma Viswanathan and Jeffrey Brock with a poem by his now late father, Van K. Brock.
The horses. Overtaking a double horse trailer, I can see only the ears and rears of the two horses. One has his tail tucked in the tailgate. One tail hangs out. The beige tails contrast with chestnut flanks. Because they are alike, the contrast makes them both appear misshapen. Somewhere between, their one form blurs and won't focus. For slight differences become the movements of horses running diagonally opposite ways in airy arenas, containing only horse torn by horses. And now, though I can't put a rein on God, I feel him tearing between the horses and myself, for we are in separate vehicles, each one moving fast. I pass hills and curves moving.
The Horses by Van K. Brock, winner of the Georgia Poet's first poetry prize in 1964 and included in his 2005 book of new and selected poems called Lightered. The founder of Anhinga Press died in March 2017 at age 84 in Fayetteville, where his son and daughter-in-law teach at the University of Arkansas. Links to this reading and to part two with Jeffrey Brock and Padma Viswanathan are at newletters.org. Today's show was produced by New Letters Magazine at UMKC with Coy Duggar, Elizabeth Albano, Sean Weir, Jordan Hooper, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.